Grossman once said, "The house of delusions is cheap to build, but drafty to live in." I would add that when he says drafty, I'm imagining a shelter potentially so flimsy that it is hazardous to your health. Humans get ugly living with the stress of maintaining houses of delusions. That's why our sixth principle makes me nervous. I cannot remember a time in my adult life when I believed humans could create a worldwide community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. So why on earth are we UUs identifying our congregations as affirming and promoting that goal? Isn't it tantamount to confessing that we are naive and deluded about human nature? Perhaps the biggest stretch of all in this affirmation is the thought of peace for all. Jim Scott, the UU hymn writer who will be appearing here Friday night on his way to Montreal, has a brief song that's in our gray hymnal called "Nothing But Peace Is Enough." The first line says, "Nothing but peace is enough for me." The next two say, "Nothing but peace is enough." And it concludes by repeating the first line, "Nothing but peace is enough for me." Now, you might hear admirable commitment in these lyrics. I've never asked you to sing them because I feel like a fraud when I say them. I know that I am too easily seduced into periods of grateful contentment that I know are neither universal or enduring. And in those moments of understanding, and in those moments, gratitude is enough for me. It's all I need. Doesn't have to be peace on a worldwide scale. Now, I don't mean to pick on Scott, but this level of affirmation of peace as a goal denies centuries of wisdom about the human weakness for violence and oppression. There's the Greek philosopher Plato. "Only the dead have seen the end of war." The German military strategist von Clausewitz. "War is the continuation of politics by other means." And then there's a real cynic, Ambrose Bierce, who says peace is just a period of cheating between wars. But I'm not here to advocate that we throw out our sixth principle. I just want us to be very clear that it is one of our clearest examples that these principles are statements of how we aspire to live together, not what we intend to accomplish. We aren't proclaiming a commitment to attain the unattainable. We aren't failures if our efforts don't lead to justice and liberty for all, much less universal peace. We are failures if we don't turn our communal efforts towards such work. What is good and sacred has never been confined to what is within our grasp. Our values urge us to be honest about what is unattainable, but to remember, unattainable is not the same as unapproachable or irrelevant. Stars that we have no way of reaching, stars that might not even exist any longer in reality, still shine in our skies every night, and often they illuminate our deepest thoughts and feelings. Our sixth principle, at best, challenges us to be realists without being defeatists. It's realistic to believe that world peace is unattainable. But experience teaches us that moments of peace and spaces of peace are constantly popping in and out of human history. The Unitarian poet and Tufts University English professor John Holmes mapped out this accessible aspect of peace. He called it the peace not past our understanding in the hymn that we just sang, written in 1948. It's light falling on a tablecloth during a winter supper, like the Shabbat meal that Michelle and I had with three Middlebury College UU students this Friday evening. This kind of peace is too simple to be scrutinized for whether it meets the definition of peace in some grand scheme. It's houses lighted every year, year after year, garden harvests and holidays. And Holmes went on to say, "This accumulation of little things too simple to be viewed as acts of making peace come true at last for those of God's good will. These are the things we mean by saying peace. The message here is that it is realistic to believe that simply by being peaceful, we strive for world peace. Thus, can we expand the domain of our encounters with peace? Thus, can we bend the arc of the universe toward peace, justice, and liberty? But there's another step beyond this kind of peacemaking. That's the conscious actions calculated to extend what we know of peace to other people. The poet Denis Levertov says that we have in our daily rhythms a feeling toward peace, but we need to actually speak the forms of peace aloud to others, to shape them by our actions, to have an impact. She calls it applying the grammar of justice to our words of deeds, the syntax of mutual aid. Now, Levertov suggested in the 1980s that our lives were like sentences that were structured to affirm profit and power. And peacemaking, she said, requires restructuring those sentences to question what our true needs are and to allow long pauses. I see a lot of wisdom in that. Sometimes peacemaking involves not doing things, not saying things, not getting caught up in the rush to what turns out to be conflict. Intentional, nonviolent resistance made conspicuous by refusal to go along. In my experience, I have to say, that tactic only works when you are sure of what you love about humanity and the earth, and that that feeling, that assurance, is more powerful than your anger. At any rate, Levertov said that only then can peace become fully realized poetry, that is to say, a beautiful energy field more intense than war. And she envisioned it pulsing into the world stanza by stanza. You may remember she said, each act of living, one of its words. Now, I love this imagery, but it feels a little bit too worked out, too advanced human brain thinking to me. I was looking for something that actually was more deeply instinctual to us. So I want to offer contagion as a different metaphor than poetry for peacemaking. Now, contagion has a bad name right now for obvious reasons. But you don't have to look far for famous people assuring us that all kinds of emotional goodies are contagious. Confidence, courage, generosity, kindness, you name it, you can find a study and a quote saying that that's contagious. And don't forget laughter. My father had an amazing laugh, loud, unrestrained. The only word for it was infectious. And I will never forget going to see the slapstick French comedy, The Mad Adventures of Rabbi Jacob, with him. It was his third time seeing it. Now, he would begin roaring with anticipatory laughter a few seconds before every funny scene. It was pretty embarrassing at first, I have to say. But soon I realized that most of the people around him couldn't resist his infectious laugh, and they were laughing too, at and with him at first, but continuing right on and into the scene that was actually funny. Now, maybe there were some folks in the theater who were offended. I didn't get that sense, though. As Monty Python member John Cleese once said, a wonderful thing about true laughter is that it just destroys any kind of system of dividing people. Psychologist Daniel Goleman says all emotions are contagious, and I suspect that understates the role of contagion in the universe as we know it. Life itself relies heavily on contagion for evolution. But let's think about peacemaking in terms of what the new coronavirus is teaching us. Imagine that instead of saying we are affirming and promoting world peace, justice, and liberty in our sixth principle, we said we're committed to infecting the world with the impulse to make peace. Let's consider first what we can hypothesize about the current nature of this infection using the coronavirus as our guide. We must assume that the impulse to be involved in peacemaking is contagious, at least in many forms. We must assume, sadly, that the impulse to peacemaking can be damaging or even deadly to individuals heavily infected with devotion to it. Just as the outcomes of infection by the coronavirus vary widely with the location and the circumstances in which it was contracted, so does the outcome of peacemaking efforts. It's far more dangerous as a citizen of North Korea to publicly antagonize the government with a peacemaking gesture than it is for a citizen of the United States. And I'm not saying the United States is the safest place in the world to do this. I'm just comparing it to North Korea. We must assume that there are far more mild cases of the impulse to work on making peace than serious ones. We must assume that there are millions of carriers of the impulse who do not see themselves as infected in any way, yet who are nonetheless capable of acting in ways that expose others to the impulse to make peace. We must assume that a true epidemic of peacemaking would have many unpredictable consequences, not all of them positive. Just as the coronavirus epidemic we would call tragic can have positive side effects, like a sharp, if temporary, decrease in global carbon emissions. We must assume that there are hot spots for this infection and others where it isn't as visible or simply isn't present yet. And now comes the part that really interests me as your minister. If CVUUS aspired to be a hotspot for peacemaking, a hotbed of contagion, who would we look for among us as our effective carriers? One of the reasons I offer communion here quarterly is that I believe Jesus, if edited through a UU lens, offers some good suggestions for cases like this. Where can we encounter folks whose health is the joy of living, who, though deprived of goods, are not lacking in goodness? Yes, give us, fellow congregants, with what our version of the Sermon on the Mount calls fruitful minds. And I pray CVUUS is a sanctuary to gather those who hunger for righteousness, and that exceeds their desire for riches, their thirst for integrity greater than their craving for power. As the UU version of Jesus, at least as interpreted by me, said, they will show us the way of justice and a love that is a road to happiness. And let us welcome each person whose heart is tender, whose sympathy lifts up the fallen and gives strength to the weak, for they will lead us in making the kind of peace where the meaning of friendship is lifted up for all to see. And I see many among you who cherish in memory those who walk with you no more, who have found in bereavement firsthand knowledge that love outlives death. You bless us with the understanding that in this respect, all who experience love are united as one. Our Jesus also said, the lonely seekers after truth, those who risk their lives and fortunes to push back the night of ignorance, disease, and poverty, are a blessing among us. As I wrote this, I was thinking specifically of Dr. Morris Earle Jr., who's traveled to Lebanon to serve Syrian refugee children in a hospital run by Doctors Without Borders. But he's not the only one among us whose example of service has provided us with lasting inspiration in the realm of peacemaking. I love that the last invocation in our communion of who blesses our impulses to peacemaking is far more general than heroic. Blessed, we say in communion, are they who build goodwill among people, respecting the endless diversity of human identity, preaching the futility of strife, and seeking creative peace. We affirm that such words and works from any among us live in our hearts and express faith that their work will enrich generations to come. So for me, the communion words suggest CVUUS is thoroughly infected with people who are capable of seeing themselves as blessed, and as a result, capable of blessing the world. These words are inspirationally vague, perhaps to the ears of an outsider. But in every verse, I see faces I recognize in this room. It remains fair, if cynical, to ask whether we are mostly individualized viruses parked temporarily in this still young organism, struggling for vitality in a world hostile to progressive faith communities. But I look out and I see a beloved community building an ever more precious version of the people's peace. And I pray that history will regard us in this latter light. May we live to make it so. Blessed be. Amen. Our closing hymn.